Ken Burns' new series on our national park debuts on PBS this Saturday. The nation's leading documentary filmmaker shares an intimate look at these special places. From the Everglades of Florida to the gates of the Arctic here in Alaska, he introduces us to the land and waters of these national treasures and to the men and women who made them possible. Millions of visitors come out to our parks every year and pay their own personal tribute, yet the system is not without controversy. So how do we feel about them? What's the status of our parks? Our national parks, the subject on the next Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Pace Correspondence School offers the education you desire for your child. They have state allotment for students not currently enrolled in a public school, K-12 curriculum, and supportive certified teachers. Pace now offers services for dyslexia, including assessment and tutoring through the STRIVE program. Enrollment information available at 866-864-5491 and paceschool.net. This message sponsored by the Craig City School District.
We're talking about our national parks in the upcoming documentary by Ken Burns. The series, The National Parks, America's Best Idea, starts Saturday night on most PBS stations and runs every night for 6 nights. Good morning. I'm Pat Yak, filling in for the vacationing Steve Heimel. You can call us during the broadcast at 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK. In Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. Or you can email us, talk@aprn.org. And if you'd like to share a park story with us, an essay or a photo or a video, you can by going to aprn.org, and you'll see an icon there inviting you to submit a story or a photo or a video. Please take a look. Joining me today are two men who know our parks well. John Quinley is a former journalist here in Alaska. Some may remember him when he was a reporter for the Anchorage Times. He is now an assistant regional director for the National Park Service here in Alaska. He is with me here in the studio. And joining us later in the program from Minnesota is another John, John Allen, a veteran bus driver at Denali National Park, and I have to say, a wonderful storyteller, and I want to thank them both. John, I want to start with you. Thanks for being with us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me here.
Ken Burns' documentary on the parks, if past tradition holds true, will draw millions of viewers. And while many of them have probably seen some parks, they will have not seen all the parks that are going to be on the show. What are you hoping this series will do for those watching the program?
Well, I think it will help people understand the breadth of the national park system and just what an incredible treasure it is that they are the owners of and the inheritors of. And whether they've visited a park or have only seen them on PBS and picture books, I hope they come away with a better understanding of really the American story. And I think that's what Burns is focusing on. It's clearly big, wonderful landscapes, but also it's a story of people and American history and the American story captured in. There are 391 units in the national park system. Burns focuses on those that have the title National Park because he would have had to have a 100-hour series if he'd gone everywhere. He had to narrow the field a little bit.
Yeah. He's been traveling the country. In fact, he was good enough to stop here in Anchorage and talk a little bit about the upcoming series. And he said then that one of the reasons that his programs, whether it's been the program on the Civil War or baseball or World War II, have asked the same question over and over and over again, which is, what does it mean to be an American? Who are we as Americans? And as people experience parks, as you've experienced parks, how have you answered that question? How have you seen others answer that question? Who are we?
Well, I think, you know, those experiences that you have in parks, and for me, it started, you know, back in California where I was growing up in Boy Scouts. It was in Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Park and summer camp and sort of those big landscapes where you can kind of test yourself. And you feel that independence of not being at home and in a dramatically large landscape where it's clear you're not in charge. And then I think later that those experiences have been maybe more subtle as you begin to look at places of American history, places in Alaska up on the Noatak, where you fly in, there's nothing around except evidence of a tent ring from thousands of years ago where, you know, the first Alaskans were hunting caribou. And unlike us, their very survival depended on finding the caribou that came through the pass. Because if it came through a different pass, they were likely not going to survive. And it's just a very poignant sort of place. So that's sort of a whole range of experiences, but wrapped up together, that's who we are as Americans.
How does the land and the water teach us those lessons or remind us who we are?
Well, I think, you know, we see places in national parks that are, particularly in the big natural parks, that are fundamentally unchanged from when earlier Americans came across the country, fundamentally unchanged from when Native Americans first came onto the continent. And that's pretty powerful to see those places. And then, in the historical parks, to see the places where history actually happened. So much today is, on a computer monitor and sort of the virtual story. National parks are the real thing. That's where, the founding fathers in 13 colonies got together and made America what it is. And there are those wonderful stories. And then there's also the stories that we would prefer many times to forget. But I think importantly, we haven't, that we tell the story of slavery in Civil War parks. We tell the story of segregation in Brown versus Board of Education, in Manzanar for the internment of Japanese Americans. Those are important stories to tell as well. And so the parks tell that whole range of stories.
Great reminders.
Yeah. It's and it's important that people who are new to America, who don't have, the history that I do of family living in the United States, going to national parks, that those places are available for them to understand the place that they've come to.
Yeah. The Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, that's certainly a mouthful, ANILCA, signed into law by Jimmy Carter in 1980, set aside more than 100 million acres of lands, federal lands here in Alaska, which about double the national park and national wildlife refuge systems. So much has happened since then. Fill in some of the gaps for us. What have been some of the big milestones since that legislation was signed?
30 years and 2 minutes. Let's see.
Go for it.
Okay. National park areas in Alaska have seen a tremendous increase in visitation. Last year, we had close to 2.5 million people come to national parks. That's been a big change over that period of time. We have done a lot in the realm of taking care of visitors in terms of construction of visitor centers and trails, historic preservation. There are now some 400 private businesses that are licensed to provide visitor services in parks. And we have not yet finished, but have made big strides in tackling some of the thornier issues that ANILCA sort of left for us, things like access to inholdings, private lands within national parks. The law didn't say a lot about it, but we've sort of begun sorting that out and hopefully making progress in that direction.
Not everyone was happy with it, and there's certainly some lingering effects of those set-asides. What are the ones that are really still nagging us as we contemplate what to do next with our lands and in the service, park service?
Well, there are a number of inholdings, private lands within national parks, and ANILCA guaranteed those landowners the right of access. And we're trying to figure out and work with landowners how best they can access their property in a way that's sensitive to the environment and responsible. I don't think ANILCA foresaw that snow machines would be traveling hundreds of miles in a day and, incredibly reliable and powerful machines. People can go a lot more places that I don't think in the mid-70s when ANILCA was being debated that people ever really anticipated folks would go by mechanized equipment. So it's changed the dynamic in some places of how places are visited. In some places, we're just struggling with growth and the numbers of visitors. Skagway gets 1 million visitors a year, primarily through cruise ships and then some overland. that's posed challenges in how we manage those historic buildings.
Yeah, I think when Burns was here, he was, I think, describing a visit to Gettysburg. And the director or someone was with him, and there was a candy bar wrapper or something on the ground, and the director picked it up and he said, "Ken Burns, Ken Burns." So we have enjoyed our parks, and there are a lot more people coming to our parks. What kind of effect has the increased visitorship to our parks meant to the parks? How have we maintained their splendor and at the same time welcomed more and more people to come visit them?
Well, we put a lot of effort towards managing people and trying to think in advance of how we're going to handle crowds of people, how we size facilities. Alaska's park visitation comes primarily from May to September and has been growing, but it's in many parks, it's fairly concentrated. At Denali, and John will be one of the people on here later, it's primarily traffic along the park road. And much of the 6 million acres of Denali, people view from afar, but they don't get off the bus and hike for miles and miles and be part of it. And so we've focused our attention on those places that are used the most. And we've tried to do it in environmentally sensitive ways. At Denali, the Eielson Visitor Center is a LEED Platinum facility. We rebuilt the old building on the same site, and there's solar power, there's hydroelectric power, it's partially underground. It's it's an amazing piece of technology out in 66 miles from the highway.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the kinds of things that we're doing to handle visitation. A lot of our visitors come, in Glacier Bay, they're on ship. And so we go to them. Park rangers go out and meet cruise ships and ride through the bay with them. And so they're, the large numbers that you hear of at Glacier Bay aren't really ever standing on the park. They're on the ships.
Yeah. Burns was asked about his favorite park, and like a very wise man, he said that would be like asking a father to pick among his children which was his favorite. So I want to ask you what's your favorite park, but I am going to ask you, where do you enjoy going the most?
Boy. That's almost, that's sort of a trick question.
Well, it is a trick question, John.
The places that I have enjoyed have been... I've loved going to see bears at Katmai in July, watching bears catch fish along the Brooks River. As much for watching other people as watching the bears, it's been a great spot. Kayaking in Kenai Fjords, and then I think just the big landscape of the northern parks along the Yukon and the Brooks Range, where you rarely see other people and you can just sort of lose yourself in the landscape.
Is there a place that you've not gone yet that you're just dying to go to that's on your list?
I have never made it to some of the parks in the far northwest, Cape Krusenstern, Bering Land Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
So those are on the list. There's still two or three on the Alaska list and a whole lot in the lower 48.
Yeah, I've been to two of the parks here now, Kenai and Denali this summer.
Mm-hmm.
And had a marvelous experience. And the only unfortunate thing about being at Denali was that I didn't know I was at Denali because it was a rainy, foggy day. And I'm sure that others have experienced that, but it was still a delightful time for us. I'm going to invite John Allen to join us. John is good enough to be coming to us from Minnesota, and I've got him on the phone. John, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, well, thank you.
I want to tell listeners what I told him the other day. I had the opportunity to take my daughter and a friend to Denali this summer, and John was the driver of our shuttle bus, and he was absolutely magnificent. He had the entire busload of campers and hikers and tourists hanging on to every word. He's a marvelous storyteller. So, John, thanks for being with us. We've been talking about the park from a big picture perspective, pardon the pun. Let's talk a minute about the park you see. You've been driving for many years. How have those experiences as a driver in the park shaped you as you've gotten to know the parks from a very intimate and close-up way?
Well, after 25 years of running over that road, what it's done is stimulate me as a writer. The endless beauty and the variety of the people you meet, I end up writing poetry and short stories that just have to come out, given what's out there.
Yeah, you've watched a lot of people enjoy the parks, too. What's been your observation of them as they get their first glimpses of Denali?
Well, it's been my experience that if the people are willing to give the park a fair chance, if they're willing to put in some time and take a look what's there, the park does not let them down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that, take time with the park? Do you think they can?
Well, you have to be willing to go out there and spend some hours.
Mm-hmm.
If you show up at the visitor center and don't see a grizzly bear and go home, well, that's not giving it a fair chance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there some special places in the park that that never fails to enchant you when you see them?
Well, yeah, of course, although part of the charm is the unsung places popping up and singing. But Polychrome Pass, up high in the rocks where the road goes up through the top there, is one of my favorite places.
Yeah, what makes it special for you?
Well, the view, for one thing. Mm-hmm. The scenery is just stunning.
Yeah.
And I was up there one day, and there was this photographer poking his camera out the window, and he was muttering to himself. He says, you know, even with a wide-angle lens, you can't do this view justice.
Yeah, yeah.
And given the beauty of the scene, that's not a bad statement at all.
Yeah. I want to remind listeners that you can call us at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-TALK. If you're in Anchorage, it's 550-8422. Or you can email us at talk@aprn.org. John Allen, I'm going to continue with your experiences. You get asked all sorts of questions. How many questions do you get asked during the course of the day? Have you ever counted them?
Well, the bus ride takes about 8 hours, and it's just kind of a continuous shower of questions. Let's just say 50 in 8 hours would be a modest guess at the number.
Yeah. What's the one you get asked the most?
How many times a day do you drive this route?
What about the park? What's the question that they ask most about the park?
Let's see. That is part of the charm of driving the bus is when it gets right down to the pragmatic part of the park, the questions don't repeat all that much. Everybody sees it through a different angle and comes up with different questions.
Yeah. Have you ever been stumped?
All the time, yes. Just about the time I get to thinking that I know what I'm talking about, somebody will come up and ask a question that, well, of course, why don't you know the answer to that? And I really should. Yes, it happens all the time.
So what was the last one that sent you looking into the reference books or elsewhere to find the answer?
Well, I'm accustomed to being asked when the United States bought Alaska from Russia. That was 1867. And I'm accustomed to being asked how much did it cost. That was $7.2 million. But just the other day, somebody asked what I think is a truly pertinent question. Somebody asked, why did Russia sell Alaska to the United States? And at the time, I didn't have a clue, and I had to fess right up with that.
Well, they thought that the furs were gone, and they had just ended the Crimean War, had they not?
That's a couple of them, yes. And I learned by researching when I ran home with the unanswered question that a third one was Russia was afraid they were going to lose Alaska anyway to England because England was very strong through their Hudson Bay Company up in the north. So if you add those three, the diminished furs, the loss of the Crimean War, so Russia needed the money, and the fact they thought they were going to lose Alaska anyway, that answers that question. But you asked about being stumped. That one stumped me pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. John Quinley, what's the question that you get asked the most in your job about the parks?
I think I get questions about Denali, frankly, and sort of how do I do it? What's the deal with the buses? And sort of explaining that whole system. And it's we have built a fairly complicated puzzle over the years, and so steering people from wherever they call to eventually getting on John's bus is probably how I helping visitors at least work their way through the system.
Yeah. John Allen, people come to see the park because they like to see the land and they like to see the landscapes, but they also come to, because they want to see the animals, and they're all abuzz about wanting to see animals that they've not seen in the wild before, like grizzlies and the like. What's an animal you haven't seen yet there? Because I presume that you've seen just about all of them that there is to see.
Yeah, I was just thinking, as far as in 25 years, I've been fortunate enough to see, certainly all the major mammals that you would find in that area. The one I've seen the least of would be the wolverine.
Yeah.
And in 25 years, I've seen two, and the first one was so far away, it might as well have been a wombat. but the second one was up close and personal.
How did they know they're there?
You mean the folks on the bus?
Just wolverines in general. Who monitors the animal population there?
Well, the National Park Service rangers are the experts on the subject of the animals, and they've been observing since the park became a park in 1917.
Yeah,
park rangers.
Yeah, how did you either meet or confront your wolverine if it was up close and personal?
Well, it was an ideal situation from a bus driver's point of view. The road was going uphill with a cliff on the left, and the cliff dropped right down into a little stream, and down in that stream, just a stone's throw down, was this wolverine. So not only did I get to see it, but all 52 passengers were right there with it.
Yeah, yeah. I saw a lynx coming into the park the day that I was driving in. Are they a common sight up there?
Well, certainly not common, no. In fact, you were fortunate to got a real gift if you did see one, in that I drove over that road for 10 years before I saw my first one.
Yeah, yeah. John Quinley, back to what people ask about. I'm sure when's a good time to come to the park is one of the top ones, and how do you answer that, given the mountain Denali has its own almost climate and weather conditions, and it can be beautiful just minutes outside the park and have a much different kind of experience in it. So what do you tell people that about when's a good time to come?
Well, I guess as far as viewing the mountain, that there's no sort of sure bet. It's actually more visible in the winter, but suggesting people come to Denali in the winter is not often met with an agreeable sound. We just talk about sort of what they want to do. The parks are open year round, and that's one of the things that that I think people don't understand is they see, the visitor season in Alaska seems fairly narrowly defined from sort of May into September, and actually the parks are open year round. But we typically find, just like I think our listeners would know, that that tends to have sort of drier days in the early part of summer, and as you head towards fall, not so much. This summer seemed wonderful the whole year through, and last year seemed crummy the whole year through. So,
yeah.
So much for my prognosis.
Yeah. John Allen, a lot of people come with camera gear and binoculars in tow. And if you were writing the tips of Denali, where would you tell them that they would want to be sure to go Where are the best spots to shoot pictures? You could probably say, well, anywhere and everywhere is a great place, depending on what's going on. But are there some very special places that you only had a limited amount of time to be in the park that you would suggest people to go to take that great photo?
Yeah, well, three places along the road stand out in my mind. First off, the Polychrome Pass area, which as you go along the road, you reach first. Then the Eielson Visitor Center, unquestionably, the reason they built the Visitor Center where it is on a clear day or a halfway decent day, you've got a killer view of Denali. And then out at the end of the road, the Wonder Lake area, you get an angle on the mountain that you can't get from anywhere else along the road. So those three places.
Yeah. You know, it must be a magical moment for you, I guess, to watch people when they come to the park. They've read about it. They've seen photographs of it. And now they're getting their chance to see it up close and personal. What's been your experience watching the visitors visit the park?
Well, that goes back to my early statement about if they give it enough time and effort, the park won't let them down, and that's manifest in their reactions. For instance, when I mentioned the photographer earlier muttering about you can't record this scene even with a wide-angle lens, the next line I heard came from someone who obviously had a good time, in that this total stranger replied to the photographer saying, trying to record Denali in photographs is like going to a party through a keyhole.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, obviously this guest had gotten the big picture and was satisfied and felt that jolt of what she had really seen beyond the camera.
Yeah. I want to remind listeners that you can call us at 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK. And in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. And you can email us at talk@aprn.org. And as I mentioned at the first of the show, if you want to share a park story, you can. You can go to aprn.org and you can post an essay or a photo or a video. And you can, again, go there and do that by going to aprn.org, and you'll see an icon there on the home page. You can post your essay or photo or video that way. We're going to take a break here. We've been reflecting this morning on our national parks and the upcoming PBS series by Ken Burns. After the break, we will talk about some more magical moments that make these parks special as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Good morning. I'm Pat Yak. I'm filling in for the vacationing Steve Heimel here on Talk of Alaska this morning. We're talking about our national parks with two experts. John Quinley is an assistant regional director for the Park Service. And John Allen is on the phone with us from Minnesota. He is a driver extraordinaire at Denali National Park. And I want to thank them both for being with us this morning. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-478-8255. or you can email us, talk@aprn.org. And before the break, I talked about this very special opportunity that you have. If you want to share an essay or a photo or a video, you can. You can go to aprn.org, and you'll see an icon there that says share your story. So I invite you to do that. John Quinlan, let's come back to some of the big picture issues now. What's some potential legislation that's out there that's swirling around either at the state level or at the national level that might be affecting the parks?
Well, I think the next piece of legislation, of course, will be the budget for upcoming fiscal year. And national parks have fared well over the last few years at the federal budget. And we're beginning to prepare for the centennial of the National Park Service, which is in 2016. And so we're looking ahead towards that. There is, the implementation coming up in February of the legislation which will allow carrying of firearms in national parks. That's of much more interest in the lower 48 than in Alaska, because actually in most of the Alaska park areas, certainly by acreage, it's already been legal. So that's a change that has come to us legislatively, which will be, I'm sure, a subject of more discussion around the country in the months to come as February approaches.
Yeah. I want to read one of the emails we've received from Matt in Valdez. He said that he wants to compliment the parks on the expansion and improvements at Wrangell St. Elias. He's used the road often and likes the new cabins and trails, and wants to congratulate and thank the Park Service. It's always probably good to hear a compliment like that.
That's always nice, yeah. Wrangell's has been a place that we have done a lot of work, particularly the historic mine buildings at Kennecott. We recently cut the ribbon on a restored general manager's office and celebrated about 10 years of restoration and stabilization work on those buildings. The state of Alaska owns the McCarthy Road, and they have done a lot to smooth that out and widen some of the corners and make the driving experience out there a lot more enjoyable.
Yeah. A lot of thought goes into making parts more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
Between when a new idea emerges and when it is completed, what's the length of time you're looking at? Is it months? Is it years?
I would say at least years.
Yeah.
and sometimes it never leaves the idea stage.
Yeah.
In the case of Wrangell St. Elias, that work at Kennecott was preceded by a lot of planning, by some reality checks as to just what you can do with the amount of money that's likely to be available.
Yeah.
In Denali, we've been talking for certainly the entire time that I've been in Alaska, 28 years, we've been talking about developing visitor facilities on the south side of the Alaska Range.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a lot of different ideas, and we have settled on one with Alaska State Parks on Curry Ridge. And the state has already put some money towards it, and we're hopeful that we will see that to fruition.
Yeah. I'm going to take a call from Heidelberg. Jackie, thank you for joining us on Talk of Alaska this morning.
Yes, it's very good to listen to you guys. You know, I went to Sitka and Ketchikan, and people brought us to these parks, and they have cabins. And I said, well, I went in awe, and I said, how marvelous. And I says, you know, Heidelberg is a small village, but yet we're so far behind. And it bothers me because we could use tourism, but I would like to see cabins out in our fishing area rather than mining.
Mm.
Because I went fishing a couple years ago, even though I'm disabled. I just steered the boat and helped my son. And when I was out there, you get away from TV, radio, everything. Nice and quiet. And I got to see where our ancestors, you know, where they used to go fishing. And I surprised my son fishing in the water, one net tree. He says, "How did you do that? Who taught you this?" I said, "Who else? I never forget my dad teaching me how to go fishing." And just to go get fish down there, it was a marvelous thing. And but in Sitka, in Ketchikan, it's very beautiful in the park. I would like to see something on Prince of Wales. Thank you.
Great.
Don Quinley?
Well, I think Jackie's experiences in cabins is probably typical, that it's a nice way to get away from life at home, whether that's in a village or in a city. And you know, most of the federal land agencies in Alaska have developed cabins. The Forest Service in Southeast Alaska, we have cabins in Wrangell St. Elias along the Yukon River and other parks as well. And I'm glad she's out and especially passing along the lessons of earlier generations.
Yeah, that's a great thing about our experiences like that when we travel, is the relationships that get developed with the people that we're traveling with, or the new relationships that get started with the people that we meet who are also enjoying being out in these great places. We have Linda on the phone from Anchorage. Linda, thank you for joining Talk of Alaska this morning.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just thought it was really appropriate this morning to call because we just drove out of the park yesterday, out of Denali National Park, through the road lottery. And we had a fabulous time, and we've been doing it since its inception, I think. So we've been really, really fortunate. But I wanted to comment on how wonderful the staff is and how great it is to have rangers along the road to help maintain the integrity of the park. And it was just a really great experience, like it always is. So thank you.
Well, Linda, you missed the opportunity, however, to be on a shuttle with John Allen. And so what's the unanswered question, if you had one, from your trip that you'd want to ask John?
Well, gosh, he's already answered a lot of them, and I have to admit that we have driven in on a shuttle with the driver by the name of Dale Eben, which you may know. So I don't know that I have an unanswered question other than, do people ever, get lost?
John Allen?
Okay, responding to, do people ever get lost? Well, it has happened, but probably not as much as you would think. I think most folks, by the time they get out there on the park road in pretty much the middle of nowhere, they're aware they're in the middle of nowhere, and they're pretty careful about getting back to the road and the bus.
Yeah, can you tell if someone's been lost, John, by the how big their eyes are when they get on the bus?
Well, to tell you the truth, I've never had that experience, so I can't say much about it.
Yeah, Linda, what was the weather like for you up there?
Well, as we were driving into the park, it was pretty miserable, but just outside of Savage River, everything just opened up, and it was spectacular. The mountain was out. We saw, all the typical animals, the grizzly bear and wolves and caribou, and it's been like a tradition for our family. My oldest is 26 now, and we started going into the park when she was just an infant. So it's just a wonderful, wonderful place, and I'm really thrilled that they have maintained the integrity of it. So you do feel like you're in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And you don't want to leave the road.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for being with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yeah. John, how many people do get lost in our parks?
A very small number. We'll have a handful of search and rescue operations in parks throughout the year, but they're surprisingly safe places. I think people who head off into the backcountry come fairly well prepared and self-reliant. The comment there that you made about sort of the family tradition, one of the mm-hmm. things that we are working on is to try to reach out to young people and young families and have them look at ways to experience national parks. Our visitation really across the country tends to be older than the population in general. And one of the themes moving forward is to do more with youth and to look for ways to get them engaged in parks and to continue the kinds of experiences that she was describing.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the notes that you sent me, and correct me if I'm wrong, John Quinley, is that while we're seeing more visitors come to the park, the diversity is not there, and that the Park Service would like to see a more diverse visitor population. What are some of the efforts the Park Service is taking to do that?
One of the things that we're trying to do is to publicize places that people may connect with because of their background, and to make it more friendly coming to particularly urban parks. Doesn't describe Alaska too well, but for instance, Santa Monica Mountains, National Recreation Area out of Los Angeles, making a real effort with school children and getting families into the park, helping with some transportation issues, programs in Spanish. And so we're a lot of different things targeted at particularly audiences that are relatively close to parks in urban areas in the lower 48. Because you're right, our visitation tends to be older and whiter than the population. And over the long term, we need to keep parks vital and relevant to the American public. People need to understand what's there and ideally experience it in person, but certainly to have that appreciation of the kinds of resources and cultural stories that national parks tell.
Yeah. I want to take a break here in a minute. Before I do, I want to thank John Allen, who has joined us from Minnesota. John, thank you so much. I hope you have a great winter and look forward to seeing you back in Alaska in the spring and summer.
Well, Pat, thank you very much for letting me be part of this. And I look forward to spring and the road opening up in Denali and another year of watching the magic.
That's great.
So thank you.
We've been reflecting this morning on our national parks and the upcoming PBS series by Ken Burns, and we'll continue to talk about parks and some of the issues they face as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. And by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
Good morning. I'm Pat Yak, and I am filling in for the vacationing Steve Heimel. We're talking about our national parks this morning. We've had John Allen on the phone with us. John is a driver up in Denali National Park. And John Quinley is an assistant regional director for the Park Service here in Alaska. You can call us at 1-800-478-8255. You can email us talk@APRN.org. And I also want to mention again a very special opportunity. If you want to share an essay or a story or your own reflections about the park, or maybe you have a great photo or a video that you want to share, you can do so by going to APRN.org, and you'll see an icon there on the page that says Share Your Story, and I invite you to do that. John Quinley, how have the laws regarding native subsistence gathering changed in the parks over the years, and what's next in that debate?
Subsistence was one of the provisions of the Alaska Lands Act that you spoke of earlier. I think the biggest shift occurred several years ago, where we moved to federal management of fishing and hunting, subsistence fishing and hunting in national park areas. There was the establishment, and this is getting into a bit of the bureaucracy, but a federal subsistence board that takes proposals and sets seasons and bag limits. And so the system has been working well, but there are, of course, changing demands from users who would like to see typically more generous hunting and fishing opportunities than what are already provided. And it's balancing those local needs and desires with maintaining a healthy resource so that those fish and game resources continue on over a long period of time. There have been issues where the state of Alaska, not so much just on subsistence, but in wildlife management in general, where the state of Alaska and national parks have different missions and approaching things differently, predator control being one of them. And I suspect that that will continue to be a debate for years to come.
Yeah. What about the issue of privatization and the selling off of lands and people wanting to buy lands? Is that still the hot topic that it used to be?
No, it really doesn't seem to be. You know, up here, the debate in around Anilka was pretty hot and heavy, but I think the doomsayers maybe have seen sort of how parks have played out over 25 or 30 years, and they're a vital part of the economy. We hire a lot of local workers. And really in Alaska, you know, if you're younger than probably 40, 45 years old, as far as, you know, you're concerned, parks have always been here.
Yeah.
You know, my children don't know a time that there weren't 54 million acres of national parklands in Alaska, and they're 19 and 22 years old. A lot of people have moved up here since 1980, and those parks have just always been there.
Yeah. I want to take Greg in Dillingham. Greg, thanks for joining us on Talk of Alaska this morning.
Yes, very good topic here in Dillingham area. We're very fortunate with almost unlimited space for exploration and hunting and camping and fishing and trapping and berry picking and snow machining and canoeing. And it's so close to town that it's so inexpensive just to buy a fishing pole and or a net and go out there. And I just see all these youth standing around the grocery store lobbies and not doing a doggone thing, and I would just like to see those people out there, the younger people. I only see old people out there, tell you the truth. It's kind of unfortunate. But those experiences that you get when you're young, the grassroots, your foundation for your future, those outside activities are just you'll have for the rest of your life, instead of just sitting around playing with your computer games and watching the boob tube. I would just like to see more youth out there. And we've got the Snow Machine organization here and the Girl Scouts, which is really great. But during these tough economic times, you know, you can just, it's a great escape to go out in the wilderness and come home with a couple buckets full of berries and a couple of fish to fry up, barbecue, and bringing home the groceries. And it's just a very valuable experience that young people should not pass up, because I'm hitting the 60s and I've been doing it my whole life and I'd like to be up there more, but that old arthritis is kicking.
Yeah.
Okay, you guys, thanks for your program.
Hey, Greg, thanks so much for calling us this morning. We appreciate it. John, what are some of the programs that the Park Service is introducing to introduce more kids and youth to come to the parks? And
I don't know, but I want to move to Dillingham, I think. Well, we've started programs to work more directly with Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts. Greg mentioned that. Here in Anchorage, we're beginning work on a partnership with a science class at Clark Middle School to try to reach out to the folks there. And at a lot of our parks, park rangers, particularly through the winter, reach out to school classes and talk about park resources. Denali, we kind of keep coming back there, but it's a handy example. They work with school classes in Healy, and they come into the park through the winter, and in science classes, they'll measure the ice and temperatures down at Horseshoe Lake near the headquarters area. So it's a real hands-on sort of experience of getting people into the parks.
Yeah.
We're doing more to communicate with people in the medium that they seem to use the most, on the internet, with websites and things like Facebook and Twitter and those sorts of
things. Yeah, that's great. We have Chris on the line from Homer. Good morning, Chris. Thanks for joining Talk of Alaska.
Oh, thank you. I had a question about Denali. It's my understanding that they have a rather remarkable record regarding bear attacks, where there have been numerous attacks there, but no one's ever been killed by a bear, if I'm not mistaken there. I'm just wondering what you credit that to, just because I just think that's really remarkable that the park's been around for so long and no one's ever been killed by a bear. And also, if you think with more people carrying firearms into parks at Denali and in the lower 48, if you think that there might be more bear shootings, because people, if they're walking around with a gun, tend to be a little more trigger happy when the bear comes around the corner.
Chris, you're right. There has not been a fatal attack in the last quite a few years, and I'm trying to think of the year, but I won't do it. So let's just say quite a few. In the backcountry use of the park, we have required campers to take the bear-resistant food containers. That has lowered dramatically the number of bears getting into food in the backcountry. We've also been much more vigilant in the front country campgrounds, cautioning people to not leave their food unattended on picnic tables, the hood of the car, that sort of thing. Those things combined have really reduced the number of bear people incidents, not quite to zero, but a significant reduction. We're doing similar things in other places, but Denali has probably the most people going through campgrounds and developed areas where there had been problems with food. On the firearms question, you know, in most of the park areas in Alaska, all of the parks established in 1980, people have been able to carry firearms, and defense of life and property kills have been fairly rare. And my guess, and it is just a guess, is that we will not see a significant change as the law changes next year, certainly in Alaska. And I guess I just can't make, I won't go out on a limb and make predictions in the lower 48. I'm just not familiar enough with those parks. It's been a lot of years since I've wandered through some of them.
Chris, you've been to Denali?
Yeah, I have. And actually just last week drove the Denali Highway as well.
And have you been into the backcountry?
I haven't been into the backcountry. I've done the bus tour a couple times, but one of these days.
Yeah, that would be great. Well, thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, it's you stop and think about it and think, well, geez, no one's been killed by a bear in the history of Denali, or at least since it's been a park.
It's you know, really the safety in the backcountry of national parks up here is surprisingly good. I think people treat the outdoors with a great deal of respect and go pretty well prepared. I suspect, frankly, some people are just lucky.
Yeah.
It's things have worked out okay in a number of places.
Well, you can, you know, there are a number of telltale signs when somebody's been in the backcountry when they get on the shuttle bus. It has a lot to do, I think, with fending off bears with whatever sprays that they've been using. And I'm sure that's contributed to it. What about the western and northern road access proposals in the park? I know there's been a lot of talk about that. And what's the latest on that?
Well, that the north access road was studied quite a bit a few years ago. The Frank Murkowski administration for the state of Alaska was particularly interested in that. The interest in that has waned over the last few years, and we're not pushing it at this point. We are working on a environmental impact statement about road access and the transportation systems on the existing park road, and how to make that better, and ways that we might be able to accommodate more people and perhaps make that transportation system simpler, more accommodating to visitors. And so I think that's the first sort of transportation change that you'll see in Denali in the next few years is the results of that study.
What were the numbers of people who visited the park this summer? Denali?
Denali was actually is likely going to be down around between 15% and 20%. It will probably be in the in the 300,000 range.
Yeah, is that attributable to the economy, do you think?
I think so. The economy has been hitting people. Cruise ship numbers held up fairly well in Southeast Alaska, but I think fewer people were doing the land packages. And next year, the expectation is there will be fewer cruise ships and fewer passengers, both in Southeast and also on the interior trip. So we may see a decline next year as well.
Did any of the parks see an uptick?
This could be Stump the Ranger, not that I know
Stump
of.
Stump the Ranger, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, attributable to the economy?
I think so. Pretty much across the board, we're going to be seeing reductions in visitation.
Yeah. Back to the series for a moment. How has the Park Service braced itself, if it has, for the series starting on Saturday? Because I would believe that it will generate a lot of interest in the service and in the parks. And so how has the Park Service tried to anticipate that increased interest?
One of the ways is making improvements to our website, which is nps.gov, and providing opportunities for the things that we think people want to do. One, of course, is to visit and to provide information on how to visit. People who want to get involved, their volunteer opportunities. This Saturday, there are a number of them across the country, and then throughout the year, parks have volunteer opportunities. And donations of people, interested in donating to assist park programs. We've made that easier, and I hope that those. I think you're mentioning 30-40 million people likely to watch the series beginning this weekend.
Yeah.
We hope that sort of numbers translates into higher visitation in parks and a greater interest in the wide story that parks tell and the other things the Park Service does.
Not to give too much of the story away, but where did Burns visit in Alaska quickly?
He hit all of the national parks in Alaska: Glacier Bay, Wrangell's, Lake Clark, Katmai, Denali, Gates of the Arctic, Kobuk.
Yeah, and which one's going to be in the documentaries, do you know?
Well, Denali is featured quite extensively, in part because it's of the national parks. It's the oldest.
Yeah, okay. I want to thank you, John, for being with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
And I want to thank John Allen, who was with us earlier this morning. John's a driver up at Denali, and Don Quinley is the assistant director at the National Park Service. If you missed any part of the program this morning, you can go to aprn.org this afternoon and hear the show. And a final reminder that the Ken Burns series begins Saturday night on the parks. Next week on Talk of Alaska, we'll have Bill Strever, an Alaska author who's written a very popular book that is getting rave reviews, Cold: Adventures in the World's Coldest Places. It's all about cold environments, cold temperatures, and cold experiences. So please join us. You won't want to miss us. I want to thank Gooseberry Peter at the controls this morning, and Lori Townsend on the phones, and BD Trantina on the phones. And thanks to all of you for listening.
Tell Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
Tell Alaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the great land. Voice data and Wi-Fi technologies at Tell Alaska, on the web at tellalaska.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Views expressed on this program are those of the
participants. Not so much anymore.
Not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.